I just can't have any social life right now.
Don't worry about it. We're just having coffee. We'll be antisocial.
Hello and welcome to our February Espresso episode. I'm joined once again by Sam. Hey, Sam.
Hey there, Matt.
And we wanted to get back to some of what we discussed for the main February episode on Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. In that episode where we talked about Tom Stoppard's film adaptation of his own iconic play, we both said, you and I, that the play is very much a stage play and that some things don't translate easily onto film. So I wanted to take this opportunity and talk a bit about that. What do we mean by that? What is kind of typical for the stage? What is more typical for film? What makes for a good film? What makes for good theater? And where are the two perhaps incompatible, or at least they tick different boxes? So when you said Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead is very much a stage play, what do you mean?
Well, I thought particularly with the example of Stoppard, and I hadn't read Stoppard in quite a while, I was reminded how much, of course, he plays with the fact that this is theatrical, and he kind of discusses the nature of the theater, in particularly in that play, but possibly also in others. And I think Rosencrantz and Guildenstern is so much a play that is set in the theatrical space and that uses this space with the knowledge of the audience that, or at least the questioning of the audience, whether this is real, whether they are alive or dead, whether the actors that join them on stage are the characters of the Hamlet play or just those traveling troupe of actors that join them. It's this absurdist discussion, obviously, of, you know, is this actually something or is it actually nothing? And I think when it came out, or it must have been such a sort of fresh breath of air to audiences who are used to more conventional plays and use of the stage, where this make-believe with set designs and costumes and so on was much more literal. And then Stoppard kind of turned it up on its head, just like Beckett did with Waiting for Godot and others at that time. So I think this play was, in a way, the discussion around theater itself. And I think that's why it was probably a tough one to translate into a film. And it's interesting that, of course, Stoppard did it himself. Mm-hmm. And looking at the film, I think, yeah, some of the things, like the locations, like the actors, the landscapes, they tried, of course, to replicate that in some filmic way. And it was attractive, I think, particularly the choice of locations and buildings. And some of the effect was there. But I thought, no, this makes much more sense seeing it on stage, probably also with an audience that appreciated Stoppard for what he did, in contrast with plays that had been ongoing before that point in time. So it's also of its time, I thought. How about you? Did you have similar feelings, or am I in a completely different wheelhouse here?
No, I would definitely agree with you on that. I do think that the film does a very good job. I do think Stoppard did a good job. But I think there are moments when the film sits uneasily between the screen and the stage. And I think it is in part because of something that you already alluded to. You talked about the audience. And obviously, when you think of theater, the audience literally shares a space with the characters or the actors or both of them, which is not the case with a film. With film, there's always, unless you're talking about Purple Rose of Cairo, there's the screen that's there, and there's the people in the audience, and they're here, and the two cannot cross over. Whereas with theater, basically an actor just has to look at an audience member, and the fourth wall is revealed to be inexistent. The fourth wall can be broken much more easily on stage because it is already very, very brittle. And I think that is connected to kind of what for me is the fundamental difference. Film conventionally is a very literal medium. What we see is what we get. Obviously, there's special effects. Obviously, there's dream sequences, all of that. But there is always this kind of baseline realism or reality, whereas the stage is never quite literal. A character is at the same time an actor, and both of these are present, and they're present with us, the audience. Which means that there's always these questions about, I mean, basically, I would say the theater is more fundamentally meta than film is.
Absolutely. And I think also the live aspect of that, right, that this is an organic performance that could be different from night to night. Obviously, some of the professionals, they will just deliver the same performance more or less every night, or so they think. But also there's a changing audience. Then they interact, they react differently. So the performance is changed by the audience, either indirectly by their maybe reactions or lack thereof, but also some plays, of course, take this as an opportunity to start interacting more or less with the audience. And I think that's also something that film just cannot do. It's always going to be tied up in a box and a product that is pretty much always the same, even though, you know, it might change the volume and the projection qualities, something like that. But there is no loop back, right, to the filmmakers or especially the actors in a film. And I think plays obviously can do that in various ways or to various degrees.
Mm, absolutely. Shall we perhaps talk a bit about, you know, where we are, how we come at this topic? Because both of us have some experience with theatre that goes beyond just going to the theatre every now and then and seeing a play.
Yeah, I would have to say with regard to film, I'm of course a consumer. I see a lot of films, both in cinemas and television and rewatches and with people and on my own. So there I'm really like mass consuming, I feel, and going into all kinds of different parts of film history. With theater, it's much more sporadic. I'm not someone who goes to the theater regularly. I do it sometimes when I travel and sometimes here in Bern, I choose particular performances. But I'm always, at the end of the year, I think, oh, I should go to the theater more, and yet I don't. And I'm much less literal in the theater world and theater language, I think, even, and I have a lot of catching up to do. Less so than with opera and with musical that I also seen even less sporadically. But I feel not very adept at, you know, theater history and different types and different eras like I do with film. You know, that's more a fish in the water there. And so I think that affects also how I perceive a play. I'm probably more in a way, more the traditionalist that enjoys a play that is like more fully immersive. And it takes me a longer time to get into things like Stoppard or Albee or Pinter that play a lot with these, or Beckett, that play a lot with these meta levels of the theater. But I find them interesting. I find them intellectually stimulating. But of course, I'm more of a emotionally affected type that enjoys being fully immersed. You know, my love for music, obviously, in film is also part of that. So theater sometimes to me is more like dry bone. It's fascinating. It's intellectually stimulating. But yeah, often it doesn't quite take me where films take me in terms of the impact.
And yet you direct on a regular basis, don't you?
I do, yeah. It's become something of a thing of mine, thanks to my school projects, where we put stage plays on with students every couple of years, I would say, on average. But yeah, if I look at the plays that I've chosen, I always call them kind of the gut punch plays. You know, my ideal play is a good mix of, I guess, tragic and comic. And I think I tend to choose things that have also been made into films or were originally films. So I think it's a bit telling that I don't go for Stoppard and Albee and Pinter again, but I would rather go for something that maybe also has filmic qualities and then put them on stage. So it's interesting, the approach I have to theater is also, I think, informed by film rather than theater tradition, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, also, it's been a long time ago by now, 20 plus years. But back at university, I also did some theatre and I also did some directing. And when we started talking about this topic of, you know, the stage versus the screen, I had to think back to a production we did back then of Richard III, so Shakespeare. And there was something there at the end which we chose to do that I think is something that only works on the stage. So basically, spoilers for a very, very old play. Richard III, of course, the evil king, the bad king, he is defeated, he is killed. What we did, we had Richard being killed on stage, obviously, and he lies there dead. And when the play's over, which is very briefly after Richard is killed, everyone came on stage to take a bow, but Richard does not get up. Now, of course, everyone knows this is an actor, this is not the character, this guy is not really dead. We had people get extremely irritated at us not resolving that tension between actor and role there for them so they could basically say, the play's over now. Now I know, okay, this is the actor. Now we no longer have this confusion. But basically keeping up this tension where the actors come on stage to take a bow, but one actor is not resolved into, I'm not the character anymore. It really had an effect on people. Not always good, not always a happy one. Some people really complained, but something like that, you can do that on stage and it creates a tension. How would you even go about trying to replicate this on film? I don't think you can.
Yeah, it wouldn't have the same effect, right? Because we need, obviously at the end of a film and a play, people, obviously they're okay to be affected by the impact of each of them, but they also want to be kind of led out of that world again. So if the actor doesn't get up and there's a possibility that is not resolved, I can see why people were partly upset by that. But it's a great trick to, of course, play with that borderline between stage and reality and our expectations thereof. So I think that only works in plays, because how would you even go about doing that on film? You know, I couldn't think of a way right now.
Absolutely. And it very much makes me think of this one conversation relatively late in Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, where Guildenstern or Rosencrantz, I always get the two of them confused.
They do that to themselves.
Indeed. Where he basically tells the player, he's angry at the player, and he says, you know, you don't understand death, you theatre people. Even as you die, you know that you will come back in a different hat. And that's exactly it, you know. A character can die in a play, and then they might be dragged off stage, and they might actually come back as a different character. Again, in film, if you do something like that, it irritates you, because there is this presumption of film being literal. If the same actor plays two characters, you presume they must be twins, or it must be a dream sequence or something. But on stage, you can have the same actor just play two, three, four different people. And obviously, you're going to draw certain conclusions from that. There might be thematic connections. Like, for instance, I think in Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, there are some quite typical doublings between the human royals and the royals from the realm of fairy, which doesn't mean that they're the same characters, but that there's some kind of connection.
Yeah, I think that's also true for a lot of Shakespeare plays, right? Also in the way troops might be cast, or small troops might actually play different roles, also for the cheapness of it. And I think that's what I enjoy about theatre, that it gets away with, in quotation marks, cheap solutions, right? If someone just puts on a different hat or puts on a different costume, but obviously we know that it's the same actor, actress. You don't scream out and complain and want your money back, right? You assume that it's part of the creative vision, or maybe the practicalities of only having 5 to 10 actors that are traveling around places with the same play. So I think there is something enjoyable about making do with the limited means that you have. And I'm thinking also of set design. I think for us, for school plays, you know, the problem obviously is budget. So you can't build big sets. But I think one of my favorite challenges is to come up with a transformable solution for something on stage. We did The Women last year, and I think we also talked about that in one of our podcasts. And I was trying to find a way, you know, because it's a kind of a lush, expensive play. You expect to see interiors and fireplaces and hair salons and nail salons and party places. And of course, we were at a loss, you know, how we're going to do that on the cheap. So I think one design that I really liked was this changeable piece of furniture. It's basically two big tubs that could be bathtubs, or they could be countertops, or they could be cupboards, closets, bars. And you could kind of shift them around, and at one side, one was tiles and the other one was like furniture brown, and changing rooms with little curtains that you could put in. So I love these things about the theater, that you say, okay, we'll just have one or two basic elements so we can just like turn it around and lay it down and tilt it over, and it will look like this. And the audience, of course, gets it. Whereas in a film, you'd say, well, you know, they just tried to film a theater play, or they really, you don't accept that as much. And I think that goes into the same direction.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I think it's this act of suspension of disbelief that is very different on stage and on screen. As you said, you know, in a film, if something looks cheap, looks unrealistic, it tends to pull people out of the illusion, because in a way, the job of maintaining the illusion is entirely the film's. it has to be credible, it has to be realistic, it has to be literal, or at least seem to be literal. Whereas on stage, suspension of disbelief is more like a pact between the people on stage and the people in the audience. This only works if the people in the audience accept this kind of trick, this kind of, it can be this, but it can also be that. To go back to that quote from Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, if someone that they just saw dying or acting dying on stage comes back in a different hat, they look at a different hat, they look at the person, they think it's a different character. No one thinks it's literally a different person. So this act of magic or storytelling or whatever you want to call it is always one that is an agreement, a tacit agreement between the theater and the audience. And I think that is something that is really largely missing in a lot of cinema.
Mm-hmm. Totally. I think also that's what makes the theater, the stage, more timeless, right? Because let's say going through movie history, there would be different standards of suspension of disbelief. And that's why I think we also react kind of viscerally to studio sets of the 1940s and 50s and upwards and downwards when we look at them with modern eyes, or with, when we look at special effects from the 1990s, the first, you know, digital ones, with a few exceptions that were already very good, we kind of say, you know, we giggle and say, well, you know, effects used to be so bad, or puppeteers or matte painting, or I think we have all kinds of different standards of what we think is a good film, the way it is made, the way it looks real. And this shifts, of course, with obviously technology, with time, with standards. Studio or location shooting, I think, is also an interesting dichotomy that has been, you know, used so differently over the decades, and different initiatives to film more on location or to go back to the studio and to film it in different ways. I think that's what makes film so fascinating, and the different eras of film, that we have also probably different preferences of what looks the most realistic to us. I recently saw this analysis of 70s cinema and saw how somehow the mid-70s were the pinnacle of ultimate realism, even in New Hollywood. And then it all went downhill again into the gaudy 80s and beyond. So where this sense of visceral reality, I think 1975 was the argument to be made, that that was the point when cinema felt most real. And I think that's an interesting discussion, right, as well, around, was there ever an objectively most realistic time in filmmaking? And I think the theater is in a better place for that, because I think that pact can be created on the whim. It can be created in one production with an audience that is maybe a bit more literal with theatrical traditions. But film audiences are more capricious.
Absolutely. And I think film audiences, this is something that I found, for instance, in online discussions, that there are many people out there who hate it when a film goes meta, when a film breaks the fourth wall. On theater, I think, you know, for instance, a character walking forward and starting to talk to the audience, no one's going to, you know, find that weird in any way. Whereas if someone does that thing, which of course is not the exact same thing, but still, if someone tries to do that same thing in a film, people have to be in the right mindset, and very often they aren't. They don't like to be reminded that what they're watching is an illusion. Whereas in theater, everyone accepts that this is all an illusion, and the point is not to make the illusion vanish. It's to make the illusion interesting somehow. And I like your point about, you know, older cinema. If you look at, yeah, the matte paintings of the 30s, 40s, 50s, even 60s, there is a kind of expressionism, again, a non-literal element here that I think you have to get used to. I absolutely understand it if modern audiences that have only seen modern films find it strange to suddenly see a matte painting that is so clearly a painting. But once you accept it does not have to be perfectly literal and realistic, you find that there can be such a beauty in that, such a magic. Again, I mean, everyone who watches a magician on stage knows it's not real. And to some extent, that makes it even more magical. You know something is not real, yet it has an impact, it has an effect.
And I think directors these days, particularly if I think of someone like, you know, Emerald Fennell, who just released Wuthering Heights, or Wes Anderson, they of course become famous by a creative vision that is clearly also unrealistic in a way that the sets are designed. We love to look at them, but they play with that as well. And I think that's a very interesting development. And I think films like, Black Narcissus that I recently saw for the first time, where there is that incredible use of matte painting, and you get into that particular realism. Examples like these, where that is kind of central to the world they create. It doesn't have to be science fiction or doesn't have to be fantasy necessarily, but just like where they put this out there and say, okay, this is the world. And even though we're going to be thrown off, this can still have an impact without the sense of like, this is supposedly real. But interestingly enough, I'm just thinking of, you know, Hitchcock, that I, of course, love to bits. When he started doing bad matte painting and bad sets, you know, starting with, I guess, the birds, Marnie, and beyond that, of course, people started to, you know, put out a lot of criticism against, you know, this is shoddy, this is cheap, you know, is it getting too old? Or is it the work of genius because he wants to make us believe that this is somewhat a fake world, and we're meant to believe that, particularly Marnie at the end, this is all artifice and it's not a real world. It heightens the reality even. So there's also interesting discussions about intention. Was it really intended to look that cheap? Or did he just like have a really bad time making this and just wanted to get it over quickly? So it can kind of tilt both ways.
Yet when it works, I think it works beautifully. Thinking of Hitchcock, I think, for instance, you know, there are a lot of scenes in North by Northwest that from, you know, through modern eyes, you might say that doesn't look realistic. You don't really believe that they're hanging from Mount Rushmore and so on and so forth. And it so doesn't matter. I mean, that film would not be improved a single bit by being remade. I mean,
oh God,
you know, heavens forfend, remade, or even, you know, look at what George Lucas did with the Star Wars movies, going back and kind of using CGI to make those scenes look more realistic, more literal, would not make them better. Because I do think when it works, there's this heightened element. There is, in a way, this joint audience and film, you know, you together make this magic by buying into the magic. And you can only buy into the magic if you don't have to pretend that there is no magic to some extent.
And I think that's what a lot of filmmakers have gotten wrong over the years, is that by adding more and more of these layers to it that supposedly better or erase this artifice, that this will make the illusion better. But it's something else, right? It's when Obi-Wan talks about the Clone Wars. You don't need to see the Clone Wars. And that's the big mistake that, of course, they did after the fact. Doesn't matter. Just hearing about, I fought with your father in the Clone Wars, this sentence delivered by Alec Guinness is enough. I never needed to see more, but they gave us more and none of it made more sense or added to the illusion. That's just one small example, but I always thought such a big mistake to make after the fact.
I do think that there are a lot of audience that are trained to kind of be hyper-literal about everything. They want the film to do the entire job of creating this world, but worlds are always better if we also take a part in creating them. Matte paintings, language, whatever. I mean, to go back to Shakespeare, since we kind of started indirectly with him, so much of his magic is in the words, but words only work if the stage is not just what you see in front of you, but the stage extends into your imagination, I think.
When I recently saw Shakespeare's Comedy of Errors, you know, there the production did such a good job of heightening the irreality of that. They cast twins that really didn't look at all like each other. And it was the kind of the running gag, the meta gag, that they didn't even try, or that the costumes somehow looked similar or made much effort in making those look the same. But it is just that element that I think every Shakespeare play also allows, that you can do the minimum and still the text will have a great effect. Or you can, of course, maximize and make great films out of it, which has been done so many times. And I think that's why, I guess, Shakespeare is always working out again, now down to Hamlet currently, that also has to play within the play element to tell its story and add this filmic meta level to it. So I think that's kind of the nugget that so many directors, both on stage and for film, go back to and say, okay, Shakespeare offers so much that we can do in both forms in very attractive ways.
Absolutely. Which I think is probably a good point at which we can move on to some concrete examples of films that I think, for instance, are adaptations of plays, but they still work as films, but also films that can be theatrical and are successfully theatrical. You already alluded to some of those. You mentioned Wuthering Heights, you mentioned the Wes Anderson films, which I think are highly theatrical and all the more unique for them. I do think when it comes to Shakespeare, Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet is one that I still like a lot. I haven't seen it in a long time, but I like that it is very theatrical, but with entirely cinematic means. It's not a play put onto screen. It is very much cinema, but it is cinema that is not literal. But again, I used the word before, expressionist, I think. It's over the top. It's brash. It's loud. The way it uses music, it uses the camera. It never tries to make you buy into a literal reality. It's an over-the-top heightened reality. And I think that's what Shakespeare does. It's what Baz Luhrmann does in Romeo and Juliet.
It's also one of my favorite adaptations, of course, even though I'm a big fan of the Zeffirelli 60s version as well, which in a way also creates this, you know, this very filmic world of Renaissance Italy, quite literally. And I think that's it beautifully done. But I think what Luhrmann did and what he does with so many of others of his projects is to heighten the reality so much that it becomes really, you feel it in every pore, right? And it's overpowering. It's visually overpowering. The music is overpowering. The acting is. But somehow, it does have a great impact. And the fact that he uses the original text to play in such a MTV world. I also thought it wouldn't work anymore, maybe for present-day audiences. But I also showed bits and pieces to students, and they're still fascinated by it. I mean, you know, his Moulin Rouge is still being played on stage these days. I think he has a good sense of how to really make these stories or these worlds his own and to make them so memorable, right? You can still visualize the church in which Juliet and Romeo lie at the end, or the beach, or the theater stage on the beach. I mean, there's so many things about the film and his films that are very memorable.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. In a way, theater very often, I think, already for cost reasons, is minimalist. It doesn't have to be, but it can very often be minimalist. I think Baz Luhrmann is maximalist, but in a way, both of these extremes meet in the middle because, again, the audience has to buy into it and they have to actively accept that. And when they do, that's when the magic can happen. I think there are films of plays that are much more sedate, much more simple, and that don't go meta, that still work. I'm thinking, for instance, of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, which makes the one mistake of having to compensate for everything in the play being in one location. So I think they try to overcompensate by kind of breaking out of that location for one scene. That's the one mistake that the film adaptation of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf makes. Other than that, I think it works exactly because it doesn't try to apologize for being a film version. It doesn't try to apologize for being based on a play. It just focuses on the characters. And I think the more character-driven a play is, perhaps the more easily it can translate onto the screen.
Well, shamefully enough, I've only seen the film version. I've never actually seen a stage version, but I love this film to bits. And I think obviously the magnetic performances by all four main actors. But I think also what really works well, surprisingly, which I think is pretty much a theatrical effect, is the storytelling that those two, George and Martha, do in the play. They create their own separate reality just by words, by their interactions about, you know, their child and what really happened. And we're this reality making between the two and the confusion it causes with the other characters. And the tragedy that, or the suspense that builds over the play. I think it's a very interesting play. I'd love to see it on stage, obviously. I don't know why I haven't. But it works really well for the film as well to create an illusion within this limited filmic world. And, you know, the conflict playing out between the different characters and relationships at the same time. But it's still like very shattering then when just this like made up thought world of the two of them collapses. And I think that's why it's such a good such good material also for film.
Absolutely. And I think that's where then the strength of cinema comes in, not just through sets, not just through kind of being epic, but here what you have is something very different. Film can be extremely intimate in a way that can work on stage, but it's difficult, especially if you've got a big theater. The camera can move in, it can be very close. You can have a character's entire face fill the screen in a way that on stage that works in the tiniest of theaters, but it doesn't work already if you've got 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 rows of audience members. You will automatically lose that element of it. And I think it's those kind of films, the kind of intimate character pieces, that can benefit greatly from that.
I think Mike Nichols also does a really good job. I'm thinking again of this final scene. I think the face of Elizabeth Taylor just fills the screen, and it's that long shot on her. Whereas at the back, I think the sun rises after the night and you see out into the garden. There's just things in there that I think really the film version really exploits in very, very interesting ways. I could see that the emotional impact of the play when you see it, the text and obviously the performances and so on, could be equally shattering, but I think he really found ways to use that in film, to translate that into film.
Plus, of course, he's got the secret or not so secret weapon of having the absolutely perfect cast.
Yes.
I think that's the thing. I've read the play multiple times, but I've not seen it on stage. But if you've got those two actors, so Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, that's the problem. I mean, basically, how can you get past actors like that? You'd have to have a very amazingly good cast to do it as well. And I think sometimes that's a shame. If you've got a really good film version of a play, it almost overwrites the play because everyone wants to see Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor. Everyone wants to see, you know, a relatively young Al Pacino as Ricky Roma and Glengarry Glen Ross. Why would you want to see someone else do a good but not fantastic job at a part that's been played in the definitive way?
Yeah, I think, and particularly Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is so the definitive film of that couple being still a couple at that time, but of course having all these tabloid stories about their issues and alcoholism and whatever was going on. And they did so many other films together, but that's the one that sticks out, right? You're not going back to Boom or Taming of the Shrew or whatever. You're going back to Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf because you kind of think that's their night. That's the night that Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton had all the time. They came back from some party and they had fights and infidelities and revelations and screamings. That's them. But you don't realize at the same time what good performances they actually are if you see both actors in other films.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So perhaps to end this conversation with, because I mean, we could go on for a very long time, but just what are some films that you like that really do manage to capture some of that theatricality, that do something that the stage usually does much better?
Yeah, you know, I realize that I have a big knack for like weak law situations in film. So films that kind of stick or plays that then are made into films or vice versa, that stick to this unity of place and action and time. And also among the plays that we put on stage, that's something I sought out in particular. And some of them that came up besides the one we already talked about is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which now obviously was a novel first, then a film and a play that's set pretty much in the same place. I'm thinking of also 12 Angry Men, first made for television, then for film, and then obviously played very often on stage. We also did like crime week lore, like, you know, Eight Women. Also the Mousetrap, I guess, is in that tradition where a crime story plays out. And I think that has very attractive variations for both film and the stage play. And yeah, to a certain extent, I feel that to me is something that I really enjoy also as a challenge to put on stage or to be made into films. I'm thinking of Cuckoo's Nest. And of course, another play that we talked about is Amadeus, that both were made into films by Miloš Forman. I think it works really well, this chamber piece set up with few characters or a group of characters stuck in a place over a certain amount of time, maybe the entire play, all the conflicts play out. And the focus is less on the stage set, even though you might of course also use that in creative ways or change it around, but really the drama playing out between those characters in that one place and maybe them not being able to get out because of, you know, they're snowed in or they're locked in and I think that to me is very attractive for both stage and screen and can be used brilliantly, as we saw with 12 Angry Men. You know, what Sidney Lumet does with this very dry bone setup of a table and 12 men discussing a case, and then he uses all these filmic tricks to draw you in, yet it also works really well on stage. I think that's probably one of my favorite hybrid materials that can be used in both ways, and shows that film and stage both have so much to offer, yet sometimes they really overlap and or complement each other in great ways.
And I think with that, you've given us a perfect final sentence or set of sentences for this episode. Thank you very much, Sam. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Say, Matt, thank you for, offering that opportunity.
And as always, thank you very much to our audience. And we will be back very, very soon with more Damn Fine Cups of Culture, Damn Fine Espressos, and lots of movie talk and cultural talk in general. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.